No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of
that was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Kathleen Gomez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the discussion by calling in at 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008, or Skype us at BBS Radio 1. Tonight, we have a very special guest, Robert White, the Director of Community Outreach for the newly created Office of the Attorney General of the District of Columbia. So I hope you will call in with your questions. Again, the number is 888-628-6008, or Skype us. Before I go any further, however, let me introduce my co-host, Kathleen, who's back in Kansas for some reason I don't understand. Still looking for your lost dog, Toto, are you, Kathleen?
No, I found him, but I was looking for my red shoes, my red ruby shoes, so I did get those too. So I'll be back in D.C., tomorrow for a couple weeks, and then maybe back out here. We'll have to see how it goes.
I remember those red shoes. I hope you find them.
I know. When I was in Italy, they stole them from you, so what can I tell you? They were popular back then. They are now,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, you and the Pope. Mm-hmm. You have the same fashion sense. I love that. Before we go any further tonight, I want to take a moment to talk about the passing of Beau Biden. This is the son of Vice President Biden, and he was the Attorney General. You know, it's somewhat coincidental that we should have Robert, who works for the Attorney General of Washington, on the day that Beau Biden passed, who was the Attorney General of Delaware. And he was a great guy, and I knew him because I went to a book signing that his father had. I worked for his father for a while, and I went to a book signing a few years ago, and riding up on the elevator to the roof where this party was for the book signing, he and I were the only two people on the elevator. So I introduced myself, and he immediately said, "Well, I'm Beau Biden." I knew who he was, of course, and we talked for a second or two while we were riding up in the elevator. But then when we got to the party, he made an effort all night long to come and get me and introduce me to prominent Washingtonians. There were a lot of important people in the room. He had a lot of politicking to do on his own. His dad was there, but still he took time out to make sure that I met all the important people that he knew from Washington. And he introduced me as their senator. And it was just a very, very kind gesture on his part. And I think it showed great character. So I'm very sad to see his passing. He was only 46 years old, Attorney General of Delaware, a combat veteran. He was a major in the National Guard and served in the Middle East. And so I just wanted to take this moment to say how sorry I am and extend my condolences to the Biden family. Beau had a wife and two children, a sister, his dad, of course, and his stepmom. So my condolences go out to them.
Very good. Yes, he was there's not too many people like that. You always see the ones who are ready to pass you along as they look for somebody better and more important to talk to. So,
right.
You know, you
and maybe you
those
have
people.
to maybe you have to be in politics like we are a little bit to understand what a nice gesture that really was. Because, yes, politicians tend to be self-centered. I'm the only exception to that rule.
You know, and I always think of Brown, you know, the what's his first name? The gentleman that we worked for who was a attorney.
Ron Brown?
Ron Brown. Gosh, I'm so old. But he was like that. He was like, you know, and we know a lot of people who are exactly the opposite. But I'll never forget, no matter where you saw Ron, wherever it was, I mean, he always made a point to come over and have a conversation, not just, you know, you know, pat you on the head and pass you along. He was a really good guy. So with that.
What a perfect segue, because tonight we have another great guy from politics
who
we met on the campaign trail. Go ahead, Kathleen.
Well, with us today, we have Robert White, who is has like extensive experience in all the in local and federal levels in the District of Columbia. And right now, he is working in basically a newly created office of the Attorney General, which just basically was voted into being, right, this election. And he's actually heading up the he's the director of community outreach at the Office of the Attorney General of the District of Columbia. And he's had an incredible past. He worked for Eleanor Holmes Norton. He also served as law clerk for the Maryland District Court for Montgomery County and for Webster, Frederickson, Korea, I'm probably not saying this right, and Puth. But he also ran for city council, and that's where we were able to, you know, stir up conversation with Robert, because, you know, we were all, there was 15 of us, right? 15 of you guys, and I was working with you, Michael, but it was a really, actually a very good experience. And with that, Mr. White, are you there?
I am here. I appreciate you so much for having me. It was a great introduction. I thought you were introducing somebody more important for a second.
No, man.
Of course, not never.
But before we start, can I just point out, we keep on calling this a newly created office because it's an elected attorney general. We've
right.
always had an attorney general, but we never elected one before. This is the first time we ever elected one.
Right, right. But it does feel like a new office. I think people view it differently now. They see it differently. They actually want to know what the heck the Office of the Attorney General does now that they've elected an attorney general. So it does feel very new.
Well, it's... it is in that sense very new. You know, Senator Strauss and I both supported the referendum that created the office because we want, you know, most states elect their attorney generals, and we didn't elect ours. And the general conventional wisdom was that if you don't elect your attorney general, then the attorney general ends up being the mayor, in this case, the mayor's attorney instead of the attorney of the people. So, you know, that was the impetus behind it. So it is. It's a whole new thing. And, of course, you have the tough job of explaining that to everybody. How's that going?
It's going well. I'm enjoying it. You know, we've been – and let me say two things early on. Of course, first, you know, I'm speaking on my own behalf and not for the office. Right. But the other thing is, if you don't mind me mentioning before we move too far away from – Bo Biden, I appreciate the remarks you gave. He really was a great guy, and I should say even during the transition, because I worked on Attorney General Carl Racine's transition team, one of the states in particular that I studied was Delaware, because they had such good outreach via social media. And so I was very impressed with what then Attorney General Bo Biden had done in his office, and really was inspired to reach new heights in terms of how we reach people through the internet because of the work that he did in his office. So it was a tremendous loss. But in terms of our office here in D.C., educating people as to what the office does and how we can better serve them is going very well. We've been getting around to ANC meetings across the city, meeting with interest groups, and really figuring out how to develop partnerships so that we can take some mutual interests and really magnify them, and also just let people know that that the Office of the Attorney General is there. And while the office, in very large part, represents city agency that the city has sued, there are also a lot of things in terms of consumer protection, in terms of neighborhood issues, that the Office of the Attorney General can do to help everyday residents in everyday issues. So it's been going very well.
Good. Well, no, it's very important. A lot of people don't understand that a lot of what happens in politics and government is really based on precedent. So the way you set this office up in the beginning will probably have a very long-reaching effect. I'm sorry. Go ahead, right. Kathleen. I know you want to ask a question.
What do you find is the most common question asked by people about, you know, what your role is and what the attorney general role, other than, you know, just like, what are you? What is the thing that they feel that the attorney general's office will have an impact on their life?
Well, it's not questions. It's more demands, but demands that I expect. As I go to meetings, people say, well, you know, I have this problem and I have that problem. How can you help me? And, you know, it's interesting because the issues between residents and other residents or residents and private companies are not generally matters that the Office of the Attorney General can get into, but we can both give them some limited advice and direction. And I've been trying to create better partnerships with a lot of the larger pro bono organizations like the D.C. Bar and a lot of organizations that do great work in the city so that I can refer people and build those bridges and put them in touch with people. But the other thing is there's just a lot of, oh, that's what you do. And a lot of gratitude from residents that the office is actually out there in the city and visible and interacting with people. So people have been somewhat surprised, but very happy to see us out there.
Well, and that's a very good, putting together a referral network is a great idea. It may be hard to believe this, but my sister was one of two women graduates in the 1964 law school class at GW, which now has more wow. women graduating, I think, than men. But in those days, she was a corporate lawyer. She used to get lots of calls from women that had domestic problems because she was a woman and one of the few women listed in the phone book. So she did exactly that after a while. After a while of telling people that she really couldn't help them, she put together a referral network of women and other lawyers that could help them, and they grew into a couple of very successful and worthwhile public interest groups that helped women. So it's a great idea to do that, Robert, to put together a referral network and get people headed in the right direction. But, yeah. You know, as my dad used to say, it's better to be lucky than good. And we got lucky with you tonight because one of the main issues in the newspaper today was budget autonomy. Can we talk about budget autonomy a little bit?
We can. We have to.
I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a lawyer, and you are. So maybe you can better explain to me what this court decision was last week. Because, you know, the mayor's out there banging the gong saying that this is really, really, really important. And the Washington Post and the former attorney general today, Irv Nathan,
yes.
and other people are saying, wait a minute, this isn't such a big deal. So what does right. that court decision that happened last week really mean?
It means that we continue to be in limbo. So the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia came out with a ruling and said, no, you know, the bill that the D.C. Council passed is not, you know, that followed the referendum where residents of the District of Columbia overwhelmingly said that they want budget autonomy. That is, you know, for those who don't live in D.C., we shouldn't take it for granted. That means that, you know, when our duly elected council and our duly elected mayor, our chief executive, pass a budget the same way that other states do, that it should become law after a layover period in Congress, which all D.C. laws have to do. But the court said that, no, the bill that D.C. passed to not give the city automatically budget autonomy, and the appeals court last week remanded the case, didn't give a significant amount of reasoning, didn't give an explanation, and said, no, this is an issue for the lower courts. So we are now continue to be in limbo. So, you know, it's a movement, but we don't really know where the ball got moved to. So I think everybody from our mayor to our attorney general, our CFO, are all trying to figure out, you know, what is the status quo, what is the next step, you know, how do we continue to move this really important issue of budget autonomy forward? So it's, you know, the ruling is still fresh. Everybody is still trying to figure it out, but it doesn't seem like it's moved the needle significantly.
Well, you know, one thing I'd like to state before I take all of Kathleen's time is that if you don't understand this out there, we don't have control over our own budget in the District of Columbia. This is for listeners that may not understand the issue. We actually are the only jurisdiction in America that has to submit our budget for approval to the Congress and also the President of the United States. They both have to sign off on it. And this is very often where Congress messes with us. It also causes us a problem because our budget often doesn't get enacted until or approved until after our fiscal year starts. So we kind of move in the dark. This would help the district a lot. Let me also say that I think in an effort to be absolutely clear on what this legislation is, it really is a semi-autonomous budget, semi-autonomy, because as Mr. White points out, it still has to sit on 30, like every law in the District of Columbia, would still have to sit before Congress for 30 legislative days before it was approved, and nobody else has to go through that. So that's what we're talking about, is actually getting control of the money that we raise locally. So I just want to point that out. Okay, Kathleen, I see you pacing back and forth. Go ahead.
No, so I guess to me, and being an outsider, which I like to be an outsider of D.C., but, you know, being out like here in Kansas and telling people about what the issue is, first of all, they all assume that D.C. is a state for some reason, even though you don't know, you know, they just see Washington, D.C. So everyone kind of figures that D.C. has the rights like everybody else in the United States. But it seems to me then that the next issue is what Congress is going to do, right? Because you guys now have the court that has said that you didn't violate the law, right, in having budget autonomy, passing this referendum. And so therefore, it just depends on if Congress acts or not. And they can do it or they can wait. They can do whatever they want. Is that correct?
Probably not. We have to submit, the question really is whether we have to submit our budget to Congress for it to follow its Congress's normal legislative process. So essentially, is D.C. going to continue to be treated as an agency of the federal government? So if you think about, for instance, the National Park Service, which is funded entirely with federal funds, you know, they go through the budget process in Congress, right, where they go to the subcommittee and the full committee, and, you know, then the Congress, the House, and the Senate pass, and the President signs it. Well, D.C.'s budget, unfortunately, it's treated just like a federal agency, even though it is not primarily funded. D.C. is not primarily funded by the federal government. And so the question is, you know, is our budget going to become law when D.C. passes it and it lays over in Congress for 30 days, or are we going to have to submit it to Congress for it to go through the entire federal legislative process? And, you know, our hope, I think, you know, the ideal is that it would not. As Senator Brown pointed out, you know, sometimes Congress doesn't pass its budget until we're well into our fiscal year, and for a local jurisdiction that just is so tough to operate that way.
Right.
So, you know,
so,
we are.
So Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, if I understand you correctly, then it's really going to be then the mayor and DC council who just decide they're going to pass, you know, the budget after going through everything, and then they'll just enact it, and then you guys will see what happens?
Well, that is the outstanding question, is whether that is the process that the city is going to take. So, yes, you're exactly right. The question now is the District of Columbia going to enact its budget and consider it passed after the 30-day layover period, or is DC going to submit its budget as is the status quo to the House and let it go through the normal federal process? So that is the question, and I think that's what our highest elected officials are sorting through now.
Well, and you know, traditionally, when this first started, just so people know what the background on the battle is, the mayor and the CFO and the former attorney general all stood behind a report from the Congressional Research Service that said that this violated the Home Rule Act and violated the anti-deficiency clause. I don't want to get too technical with people, but and now it seems that those same people, the current attorney general and the CFO and the other people involved, haven't really stepped away from that opinion. I don't know that they've said that yes, we necessarily agree with that, but they've at least said we need to take a serious look at this because it may in fact be a violation of our Home Rule Charter. And again, I don't know because I'm not a lawyer, Robert, but it seems to me when the Constitution says in all cases whatsoever, that's a loophole that we just can't find. You know, it's a mountain. It seems to me that we keep on trying to attack this, what we call the district clause of the Constitution, but we never get anywhere because it's pretty absolute, isn't it? In all cases whatsoever. I think that may be the only place in the Constitution where that language is actually used.
Well, it may be. I'm not sure. But as of probably all cases of law, it's not absolutely clear because Congress, even if the district had strict budget autonomy and legislative autonomy, that is to say that as soon as our laws are passed by our council and signed by the mayor, they became law, Congress would still have the authority to overturn anything that we did. So many argue that even if we had autonomy, it would not conflict with the strict wording of the Constitution. But it is the case, I think, that so long as the district is not a state, we will not have equal representation with the rest of the nation. And, you know, if I could just add one point to the great clarification that you gave earlier for people who are not fully aware of the district's plight, you know, some people do understand that the district is not a state, but don't understand that it is not a territory. So, you know, Puerto Rico and the other territories don't pay federal taxes. So you correctly call the district a colony because we pay federal taxes like every state, but we just don't have the same representation. And that is, I think, our chief goal in the district for us to be treated as full citizens of the United States.
And let me ask this question, because there's going to be more maybe in detail questions we ask, but as you brought up, what a great segue into this conversation is that, you know, I've always been amazed. I went to school at AU, lived there for quite a while, and nobody
go Eagles
back in the pardon?
Go Eagles.
Yes. I went
to Robertson AU alumni.
That's right. I saw that. And Pat Brown, the better half of Michael Brown, also is a communications graduate from AU. And anyway, I you know, people never really talked about DC being a state. It wasn't that big of a deal, I think, at that time. Maybe the times, there was the other things going on. But coming back to D.C., there seems to be two levels. You know, the people that I know that have lived in D.C. for 20, 30 years, and when you mention state, you know, D.C. becoming a state, completely become like, oh, yeah, well, never in our lifetime. Oh, well, that's just forget about it, you know. But it amazes me because a lot of these people are Democratic. They're standing for the protection of, you know, gay people's rights, for the transgender, for the women, for whatever. But they don't understand that part of the biggest stepping stone to democracy is giving, in our country, representation for paying all these taxes. And yet there seems such a disconnect. So now that you ran for city council and you see that there was a great swell of grassroots support for state becoming a state, and this kind of upper level that seems to think that it's just too much of pie in the sky, where do you think, or what is happening in your vision for the whole issue of statehood for D.C.?
I'm a native Washingtonian, fifth generation, so it's something, statehood is something I deeply believe in. And, you know, as soon as we succumb to the thought that it's too pie in the sky or it's too far-reaching, then we have defeated ourselves. You know, there are many civil rights issues and efforts that have taken many years, but the reason that we have been so successful in the past probably 50 years with so many issues is because we're a core people, core group of people who refuse to quit. I think that we have to continue to fight for statehood, and that's going to require a lot. It's going to require a great deal of education, particularly for folks who are outside of D.C. and don't think about the status, the political status of the District of Columbia. But the other thing that worries me really deep in my heart, and you really touched on this, is how much people in the district have maybe become fatigued or used to our status as second-class citizens. And so, you know, when we have our statehood rallies and other lobbying days and other efforts, you just don't see the number of people that you would like to see, particularly given the fact that, and again, something you pointed out, there are large numbers of people in D.C. advocating for LGBT rights, for environmental issues, but you just don't see those numbers that you need to see from D.C. residents for D.C. statehood. I don't think many people would argue that they're looking for another end goal other than statehood. So there are a few factions who have different philosophies on how we get there, but I think the majority of us agree that statehood is where we need to be.
Well, you know, first of all, the fact that you use the word fatigue, I think, is, you know, that's really, really gets to the core of what's going on. And I've thought about this for years. You know, it's just like when you have a house on the market and it's been on the market for a year. Real estate agents tell you to take it off they call it market fatigue, you know, take it off the market for a while because people, you know, have forgotten about it. And I think that's very true with statehood. I think fatigue is really the perfect word to use. And, you know, we're going to take a break in a minute and play a song in memory of Beau Biden. Before we do that, I just want to tell you, the people that are out there listening, that I met Robert White on the campaign trail, and we both ran for an office where 15 people were running. Robert was a great candidate. He was endorsed by the Washington Post. He did very well. Both of us finished in the top five, so I think we can be proud of that. And I just want you to know, Robert, that you know, you were one of the candidates that really stood out in my mind, because you obviously do this because you care about the District of Columbia. And I think you can tell that right away on the campaign trail. It's why people are involved in the race. And I think that you certainly were one of the candidates that was a standout, because you always cared about the city. And I thank you for being on our show today. And we're going to take a little break. I hope you'll stay with us. But I think that really comes through when you speak, that you care deeply about this city. And I think it's true that we need more people like you. It's good that you stayed in government, because we need more people like you in Washington, D.C.
I really appreciate that.
Yes, please come back, because I have questions.
You have a question.
I'll be back.
Yeah.
Right now we're going to take a little break so Kathleen can yell at me for not letting her talk enough. And here's a song from Dion. It's a classic, and we'll be back in a minute.
Anybody here seen my old friend Abraham? Can you tell me where he's gone?
And we're back with Robert White, who has been kind enough to join us from the Office of the Attorney General of the District of Columbia. I'm going to let Kathleen ask the next question, because she yelled at me during the song, and she told me I was old. So I'm going to go over and sulk in the corner while she gets to ask the next question. Go ahead, Kathleen.
Well, okay, well, I'll just go for it. Do you see the Attorney General's office taking, I mean, you know, I'm always amazed, because both with Senator Strauss and Senator Brown, and even the representative, of course, Eleanor Norton Holmes, that there's such a huge turnout and people vote for these positions. You know, I think Michael got 207,000 votes, and I know there was a high turnout for this, for citizens to vote for the person they wanted to run the Attorney General's office. So do you see that office having any kind of strategy or getting involved in statehood issues?
Well, given the role of the office as really the chief legal office for the city, you know, the role that it plays will likely be similar to the role in statehood and D.C. autonomy that the office has played in the past. That is to be a legal advisor to say, you know, this strategy that the council wants to take or that the mayor wants to take is going to be legally sufficient or not. That will probably be the primary role, but you know, but there are other things that we can do, such as educate attorneys general from other states on what really is the status of the District of Columbia, and in fact, I'm happy to report that Attorney General Racine has been doing that. He's been going to conferences with attorneys general from across the country and really speaking on consistently the issue of D.C. autonomy and statehood so that they know and so that we can really create allies in the state. I think that the role, the office of Attorney General is probably less divisive than the gubernatorial offices that may be more encumbered by party status. I think attorneys general understand what their roles are across states, across party lines, and are more willing to step up in support of each other on issues of what are frankly right and wrong. So I think it will play a role in statehood and autonomy, but I think it'll start as an educational role.
Well, that's such an important thing for us, Robert, because we did a poll, DC Vote did a poll back in the 1980s that showed that, I'm sorry, in the 1990s, that showed that 80% of the American people don't understand our status. They agree that we should be equal, but 80% of them actually think we are equal, because it's kind of counterintuitive to think that the capital of the world's greatest democracy lacks democracy. So they assume that we have equal representation. So it's really important to get out there and spread the word. And it's great to hear that Attorney General Racine is doing exactly that. I'd like to ask, tap into your experience on Capitol Hill a little bit, because I believe you were up there while we were fighting for the D.C. Voting Rights Act. Isn't that correct?
Oh, yes.
Correct?
Even in 2008 when we got so close.
Yes. And so, do you have a sense of why this always goes wrong for us? I mean, is it strictly a partisan issue, do you think? You know, we now have this new legislation that Congresswoman Norton has put in, H.R. 317, which is another statehood bill. We have 120 co-sponsors so far in Congress, in the House. We expect that Senator Carper will introduce a companion bill very shortly. But in the House, we have 120 co-sponsors, every one of them a Democrat, not one Republican. I see it primarily statehood on Capitol Hill as a partisan issue. Do you think the same thing? Is it all about partisan politics, or is there something else going on?
No, I think it is, and I should take the opportunity to really commend our delegation. You all have done an outstanding job getting co-sponsors on this, just really tremendous and probably unprecedented. But it is partisan, unfortunately. The fact of the matter is, D.C. is a pretty reliably Democratic jurisdiction. So if we get a vote in the House, if we get two votes in the Senate, then those will likely be Democratic votes. And, I think if they'd be Republican votes, then you might have the same number of co-sponsors, but they might be from a different party. But, we also should not, as district residents, take for granted or forget the fact that there are jurisdictional issues as well. If the district was a state and we could tax income at its source, given the fact that D.C. swells, I think, by three times our population during the workday, could bring in a significant amount of money and support ourselves probably as a state if we could tax income, as other states have the prerogative to do. That would put a burden on Maryland and Virginia. So if we started getting close, then we may have a tough time getting even Democrats in the surrounding jurisdictions to support our efforts.
Well, that's funny. That's so true. And other jurisdictions do it. And D.C. Appleseed tells us that we lose between $2 and $3 billion a year, which is a third of our budget. But when we had the last piece of legislation in the last Congress, we had three of the four United States senators from Maryland and Virginia as co-sponsors. So
we seem to be
getting around that a little bit. But yes, that's a big, deal. And in fact, our former mayor used to quip when they would ask him what he wanted his next job to be. He would say he wanted to be a toll taker on the 14th Street Bridge, because it gets annoying that all these people from Maryland and Virginia use our streets and use all our resources, use police and fire and everything else. And they don't pay anything for it. It's
that's
really
right.
Annoying.
It's interesting. I have a question here that somebody Skyped in about. They said, okay, about the Attorney General's office taking some of the proceeds from litigation and retaining the money for use by your office instead of putting it in the general fund. Can you explain that? And what would your office use the money for? Is it like sustainability within its own department?
Yeah, well, so there are, some issues that the Attorney General ran on, and that really resonated with people like consumer protection. That is, take into court businesses that come and try to take advantage of residents, and you especially think of senior citizens who are preyed on all the time, and really making sure that the office is able to fully represent residents, fully stand up for residents. When you think about it, our office has, I think we have two full-time, what we would consider consumer protection attorneys. Jurisdictions like California, New York, some other states have about 75 or more. So we don't have the resources to be the advocate for residents that people expect the office to be, particularly when they have elected an attorney general to be their advocate. And so in looking at what is the most prudent way of stepping up these efforts, well, the only way to get around pulling money from other agencies or other programs that are going on in the city is to say, well, we can bring the money in. And so the budget for the Attorney General's office is about $55 million. That's roughly 1% of the district's budget, so not a significant amount. But we actually protect or bring in about $1 billion for the city. And so we're saying, you know, in order to really ramp up the efforts that people have been asking for and people expect, the only way to do that without affecting other programs in the city is to retain a small fraction of the money that the agency brings in through settlements. So already this year, we've reached a settlement with Standard & Poor's whereby the office has brought in $21 million into the district's coffers, and we're in the final stages of negotiations on a settlement with the online hotel booking companies. That's going to bring in between $60 and $90 million. And so these are the things that we do on behalf of the district. But, you know, if this is what we're doing now, imagine what the office could do if we had more than two attorneys working on consumer protection issues. So I think it would be really a net benefit to the city. And in fact, it probably would not cost the city money. It would probably actually gain the city money.
And you'd be independent, which is always a good thing, not to be susceptible to political issues or whatever it may be, right?
The annual appropriations wrangling and caught in those crosshairs,
And, you know, it's funny, I guess people don't want to call in and compete with Kathleen, but I have another Skype question that fits right, kind of dovetails. So we at least know people are out there listening. And this listener wants to know, how is your office being received within the D.C. government? She's person writes, I know there's already been a little turf war with the mayor over who does what. And so how are you being received inside the government? Are people enthusiastic about having an elected attorney general as opposed to an appointed one? Are you getting any feedback on that from other agencies?
I think we've been received very well. We've been partnering with other agencies from MPD to the Department on Aging. We've really, it's been great as we have ramped up various efforts, whether they're kind of neighborhood efforts, shutting down some of the shops that are selling synthetic drugs to our consumer protection efforts and training educational seminars geared towards seniors and others. Agencies have really been clamoring to work with us and as partners. And, of course, I can't tell you how that compares to, say, last year or other years where there was an appointed attorney general because I wasn't in the office. I would say that there's a really consistent effort from agencies to work with us. So I think it's been great, and that's the way it should be, because we've been doing the same. We've been reaching out to agencies who are experts in their fields to figure out how we can work together to support each other.
And what do you do with MPD, given that this is another thing people might not know about the District of Columbia, but we don't prosecute many of our own crimes. We don't prosecute people in the District of Columbia. The federal government does that for us. What kind of work do you do with the police department as officially? What is your, do you have a role with them?
Yes, great question. So and I appreciate you bringing this up, because most people, as we mentioned earlier, don't know what the Office of the Attorney General does. in D.C., we actually do prosecute, but we prosecute primarily juvenile crimes. Most juvenile crimes are prosecuted by our office, the Office of the Attorney General, and most adult crimes are prosecuted by the U.S. Attorney's issue, which is another home rule issue, I should add.
Right.
But because we do that, we do have a role with NPD, but both agencies, ours and NPD, have an interest in improving the quality of life in neighborhoods and preventing crime. So we work with NPD on nuisance issues. So, if there's a home in your neighborhood where there's a prostitution, drug, or gun issue, we work with them to put an end to that, to stop that. Corner stores that are selling synthetic drugs, we work with NPD to shut those stores down. Of course, general crime issues, particularly as they have to do with juveniles, but not exclusively, we work with NPD on really overlapping efforts there. So we do have a great partnership with them.
And I gather then you guys would be very involved in, and this becomes a back where statehood becomes another issue when it becomes to gun control laws and the marijuana laws. You know, that seems to be, I mean, do you guys have a lot
right.
to do with the interpretation of how you're going to enforce the marijuana laws and how do you deal with your gun control laws?
Well, very much, and particularly though on the front end for us to... for the Office of the Attorney General to interpret what the marijuana laws are, their consistency with federal laws, and as these bills really pass through the council, the Office of the Attorney General does the legal sufficiency review, but also as the district grapples with our gun laws and how do we draft them and how do they comply with the court rulings and with federal regulations, we play a very major role there in helping the council and the mayor draft laws that are consistent with the limitations put on us by the federal government and by the court.
One more question. So I'm a D.C. resident, and while I can't smoke marijuana in public, I can carry, let's say, 2 ounces and not be arrested and thrown in jail as far as what the D.C. law is. Now, D.C. is, that you don't know when sometimes you're in federal land or state or D.C., property. So what happens to the D.C. resident if he crosses the street, he's on D.C. property, he has an ounce marijuana in his pocket, and he crosses over the street, and for some reason, the park police or the Capitol Police or whoever it may be pulls him or asks, does something, say searches him, or they just want to question him, and he has an ounce of pot. What does your office get involved in any of that?
I'm probably not. What is very important for people to understand, and it's tremendously important. And in fact, our office and I think the mayor's office has done the same thing, has put out fact sheets and guidelines so that people understand. But under federal laws, marijuana still is an illegal substance. And so people in the district still have to be very conscious of where they are and what they're doing. And we've been working hard to add some clarity for folks so that they do understand what the law is, because the laws passed by the D.C. Council legalizing small amounts of marijuana was not a carte blanche legalization to grow and have and use any amount that you want, and certainly you cannot sell it legally in the District of Columbia unless you are an approved medical provider. So people still have to be careful, but we try to be proactive to help people understand and to do that education. And in fact, you raise a good issue. We may have to look at going around to different neighborhoods, doing an educational piece, really talking to folks one-on-one directly in person so that they do better understand the nuances of the law.
Well, and we should point out that when the city council, whose job it is to regulate this, whose job it would be to regulate this, sat down and tried to have a hearing last year, a couple of our Republican friends, primarily a guy named Andy Harris from Maryland, intervened and threatened the chairman of the city council and council members that if they ever even met on trying to create laws to regulate marijuana, that it would be a violation of something that they attached to our budget. So again, it's a statehood issue on many levels.
Well, imagine that. It's almost time. It's almost time, Michael.
Yes. I know, and I want to say one last thing. I want to say, before I let Kathleen say one last thing, I want to say one last thing, and that is that, Robert, you are a great candidate. I assume because you're a young man and you care deeply about your city that you'll run again. I want to be the first person on record to say that I want to be your campaign manager when you run for your next political office. And I want to give a shout-out to your wife, Christy. Because Robert is married to a lovely lady who showed up for everything. Is that right, Kathleen?
Yes,
we got signatures with her. We saw her at everything. And the reason that this really impressed me is because I've been doing it for 35 years. My wife hates it with a passion. She supports me. She's a wonderful woman that supports me, but she hates doing it because it's very, very hard. It's hard to have somebody that you care about sit up there and watch people take pot shots at them. As you know, some people are very nice. Some people are terrible. The press is always terrible. And so it's tough for her to do that. So please say hello for me. She really did a wonderful job. And we really look forward to your next campaign. I truly mean that. I'm sure
and
that
Robert,
I'm
going to cut Michael off, but is there any kind of website or anything that you want the public to know if they have any questions that they could call or go onto the computer and look you guys up?
Yeah, well, I want to give you our website, and I also want to give folks my information so that, you know, if they have a question or if they need to access the office, they feel like they have an access point. So the website for the Office of the Attorney General is www.oag, Office of the Attorney General, .dc.gov, and my email address is Robert C as in Charles dot White at dc.gov. And so, you know, feel free anytime if you have a question, if you have a concern, to reach out to me. But please let me take the opportunity to thank you both for having me on. While I do not miss the tiring campaign pace, I do miss seeing you both virtually every day. and Senator Brown, I'm so humbled by your compliments, by your offer. I truly appreciate it. You've been an advocate here for many years, really leading a lot of our fights. So I appreciate you having me on. I appreciate you carrying this banner for this city. And you know, I want to encourage you to keep fighting this fight and keep educating people because it's just tremendously important. Education is the only way that we reach, I think, our ultimate goal of statehood. So thank you for all that you've done.
Well, thank you, Robert, and I hope you'll come back again soon so we can talk about more of the issues affecting the district government. Okay, Kathleen, say goodbye.
Yes, goodbye, everybody. Thank you so much, Robert White, for coming on. We miss you, too. And, you know, listen, we're going to have the conversation is going to be on college loans and border security, statehood, guns, all kinds of great issues. And we're going to have people about the 2016 presidential race and also propositions that are going to be on your local ballots. So please tune in.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.